It's the 25th of January 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is the RI more destitute than institute? Was Lance Armstrong a cycling champion, or was that a load of anabolics? Did a new revelation about tetrapod vertebrae send a shiver down the evolutionary biologist's spine? Will cloning Neanderthals lead to worries about the BNP having an electoral advantage? And just how groundbreaking is fracking? But first, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us pay all of the server bills and all of that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now we start the show this week with a science story. And, well, we know when there's a science story in the news, it's common for the media to claim that textbooks may have to be rewritten. But in the case of this story, textbooks may just have to be turned upside down, as it turns out that some of the earliest land vertebrate spines went the other way around. I think this story has legs. That almost works. With more, here's Liz Luckendorf.
Dr. Stephanie Pearce is an evolutionary biomechanist at the Royal Veterinary College in London. She and her colleagues published a paper last week which has potential to change the way we think about how the earliest land animals moved. It all sounded very interesting and a bit technical, and as always with a lot of science reporting, it left me wanting to know a lot more. Thankfully, Stephanie was up for a quick chat about her research and what it means for our understanding of tetrapods and the evolution of the backbone. To start off with technical explanations, here's Stephanie explaining what exactly evolutionary biomechanics means.
It's a really fancy word, but basically it's the study of the anatomy of animals and how that anatomy functions. And basically what I do is I look at the relationship between an animal's anatomy and how it functions and how that's changed over evolutionary time. So you can look at this in a variety of different ways. Some people look at evolutionary biomechanics from a cellular level. I personally look at it from a whole animal biology level. And you can look at it in different ways. You can look at how differences in tooth shape might have an impact on how an animal feeds. Or you could also look at how differences in the shape and proportion of limbs might affect how an animal moves. And so basically that's the real simple definition of biomechanics, and the evolution part is how that has changed over time.
So your paper was based on specific types of fossils. What were those fossils?
The fossils that we examined come from the Devonian period. That's around 360 million years ago. And they are extinct animals that represent some of the first known animals to belong to the group called tetrapods. Now, tetrapods are defined by any animal that has limbs with digits. Basically, animals like salamanders and lizards and crocodiles and elephants and even humans are tetrapods. And these tetrapods are a lot different to their fish precursors because fish, of course, have fins. So at one point, fish with fins evolved into tetrapods with limbs. So the animals that we looked at are some of the very first animals to evolve limbs with digits. And some of the animals that we looked at include the really infamous animal Ichthyostega, which is from the Devonian of Greenland, and also its contemporary, an animal called Acanthostega. But we also looked at an animal that occurs a bit later on in the fossil record in the Carboniferous period, and this animal is known as Pedipedes. So those are the three basic animals that we looked at during the course of our study.
And what interested you in this research project? Is it a continuation of something you've studied before?
It's a continuation of a project that we've been doing over a number of years, and I've been doing this in collaboration with one in particular researcher, Jenny Clack, who has been researching early tetrapods for about 30 years. So this is an ongoing piece of research, and the reason that we are looking at the evolution of locomotion in early tetrapods is because the evolution of tetrapods was actually one of the most important evolutionary events in Earth's history, because it is actually when fish transitioned into tetrapods and animals moved from living in water to moving on land. So this point in history is basically setting the stage for the evolution of all land animals. So it's incredibly interesting and incredibly important to research this particular event in Earth's history.
The reports mention that the technique you used to study the tetrapods hasn't been used before, and this was propagation phase contrast X-ray synchrotron microtomography, which is quite a mouthful. Can you tell us what that is?
Okay, so, well, first of all, it's important to note that the technique that we used has actually been used for imaging other fossil samples, for instance, some hominid skulls. But this is actually the first time we've used it on really, really old early tetrapod fossils. Propagation phase contrast X-ray synchrotron microtomography is a really, really long word for basically saying a very, very, very high energy X-ray system. And what the synchrotron is able to do, because it's so high energy, is that it's able to penetrate very, very dense objects, including fossils that are embedded in rock. So this is really good for us because the X-rays that are produced are very high resolution, and they allow us to look at very, very detailed images of the fossils that are embedded inside the rock. They also allow us to recreate and investigate the fossils in three dimensions.
So how had these specimens been studied before you decided to use this type of procedure?
One of the main animals in the study, which was Ichthyostega, has actually been known since about the 1930s. So its fossils have been studied for almost 100 years now. They've been actually intensively studied from a number of different perspectives because this animal is so incredibly important for understanding the evolution of tetrapods. But the majority of past studies have looked at the fossils that you can see outside of the rock. And what our study did is that we actually were able to look at the fossils that were still embedded inside the rock. So these were parts of the animal that no one had ever seen before. And that's what makes this study so incredibly important.
So what broadly, and I know it was quite a technical paper, did your study find out?
Basically, when we were looking at the backbone of the animal Ichthyostega from the synchrotron scans, we couldn't actually identify all the different bones that were supposed to make up the backbone, all the bones that had been described in the literature and in textbooks over about the last 100 years. And so this was really puzzling. Also, we found a series of bones that shouldn't be there at all. So something unusual was happening in the backbone of this animal. Now, I think it's really important to let you know that the backbone of an early tetrapod looks different than a modern tetrapod, such as a human. In a human, the backbone is composed of a series of units that are all interconnected, and these units are known as vertebrae. And each vertebra, for instance, in a human is composed of one bone. And if you look at an early tetrapod, you see that's very different. In an early tetrapod, their vertebrae are composed of many bones. For instance, they have one bone that sits, that is supposed to sit in the front. It's known as the intercentrum. They have another bone that sits on the top, which is called the neural spine. And they have a pair of bones that sit at the back. These are known as the pleurocentra. Taking that picture of how we thought the early tetrapod backbone was put together, and when we were looking at our fossils, we were thinking, well, we can't actually see those three different sets of bones. When we looked at it in a lot of detail, we found that the bone that was supposed to be in the front, so the intercentrum, was actually fused onto the back of the pleurocentra, the bones that were supposed to be sitting in the back. So this was completely weird. And when we thought about it, we realized that what had previously been described as the anatomy of these of the backbone in these animals actually had it wrong. They actually had the backbone back to front, if that makes any sense. So the first bone in the series, the intercentrum, was actually the last bone because it was the one that was fused onto the back. So this was quite a realization that for 100 years we had actually had the backbone backwards in these animals. So that was quite exciting to find. On top of this information that we discovered on the backbone, we also found out that those extra bones that were in Ichthyostega were actually the first evolutionary attempt at making a breastbone. And a breastbone is also known as a sternum. And a sternum is only found in land animals. So that's really interesting. So it suggests that the animal was creating a platform on its chest, maybe for it to support its body weight while it was on land. And this actually got us really excited because last year we published a paper that suggested that the animal Ichthyostega might have moved on land by dragging itself across the land using its forelimbs, with its hind limbs and tail sort of dragging behind it. And so having a sternum would have allowed the animal to support its body weight on its chest while it did this. And so this was really exciting because I think it lends support to the fact that maybe Ichthyostega might have been making some tentative steps onto land.
So the articles that I was reading said that your study shed light on how the modern backbone evolved. Is that an accurate description?
I don't think that our study in particular tells us how the modern backbone evolved, but what it does is that it sets the stage. It gives us the starting image, the starting anatomy from which the backbone did evolve. So by knowing the starting point, we can start to build a picture, an evolutionary picture of the transition from a backbone made up of many bones into a backbone that's only made up of one bone.
Do you think there needs to be more research done before this new theory is accepted? Or is it a fundamental shift in the way we view the anatomy of these tetrapods?
Well, I think our study definitely changes the way that we view the anatomy of these animals. It has completely reversed the backbone structure in these animals, and that's incredibly important. But scientific research never ends. We always have to do look more at the fossils. We have to ask more questions. And we have to start to build a picture of the evolutionary sequence. So really, this is only the beginning of our understanding of the evolution of the backbone in land animals.
You can find a link to the paper's abstract, Vertebral Architecture in the Earliest Stem Tetrapods, if you're keen, and if you have a subscription to Nature, you can actually read it. This has been Liz Lischendorf with all your tetrapod gossip for the Pod Delusion.
Okay, Phil, my dear, picture the scene. It's the middle of the night, a bedside table. The camera pans across the bed to a sleeping David Attenborough. Suddenly, there's a tap on the window. Every few seconds, tap, tap, tap. Buckyballs are being thrown from outside by Nobel Prize winner Sir Harry Kroto. Attenborough is woken by the noise and stumbles out of bed towards the window. Harry? He asks, still half asleep. Come on, Dave, we're getting the band back together. We need to save the Royal Institution. It's 3 a.m, says Attenborough. But science doesn't sleep, he responds. To Mayfair, cries Attenborough. Let's travel by the massive eagles that I can command. Now, that diversion into radio drama for a moment there was to underline the point that at the end of last week, it was revealed that the historic Royal Institution is being put up for sale because they've got no money left. But why is this important, and what can be done to save the building? Earlier, I spoke to Mary Perkins, who was running a campaign to save it. I started by asking her a fairly stupid question, and that's, what actually is it that the RI does?
They're an independent charity, and they describe themselves as an independent charity that connects ordinary people with the world of science, which I think is a good summary. And I think they do that in a way that no other organisation really does. For me, they're about discovery and innovation and inspiration. And, you know, you go to the building and there's 200 years of history-making science, you know, in their Faraday Museum, but also they're an active centre for scientific research. You may have heard of the Davy Faraday Research Labs. So they've got this active research going on, but ordinary people can engage with that because they run lots of public science events. You've probably heard of the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures. which are broadcast to, I mean, I think the viewing figures in 2011 were over 4 million for those, and they've been around since the 1800s when Michael Faraday started them. And I was fortunate enough to attend Christmas lectures when I was, I don't know, about 11, and maths master classes. So there's all of this, and their research continues to contribute and influence a multitude of areas of science and technology. And but we wouldn't be talking now if it wasn't for Faraday's work on electricity. So, you know, there's so much there in terms of what they're doing now and the history. It's an amazing, amazing place.
It was in the news this week, and the reason that you've started the campaign is because, well, frankly, they need some more money, and now they've announced that they want to sell off the famous building on Albemarle Street. How did they get into this state?
Yes, it was unfortunate, really. A few years ago, the then people in charge decided that the building needed refurbishment, which I think it did. But unfortunately, the cost of that refurbishment was, I'm trying to recall now, I think it was something like £22 million, which for a charity is quite a lot of money. And I think they ended up having to borrow a certain amount of money, obviously, to make that happen. And they had to sell off some property they had in order to raise money as well. And it was hoped at the time that there would be lots of things coming into the RI as a result that would help sort that out. But I think, unfortunately, what's happened is that there was perhaps, they overstretched themselves slightly in the spending for the refurbishment. And then, of course, the recession hit, so there were fewer people coming into the building. And I think, really, there needs to be a bit of a push in terms of using the building, renting the space out for people to use for events more and that kind of thing, because it's not bringing in quite enough money at the moment. So it's this difficult situation where, you know, they're in debt but don't really have a way to pay that debt off. And I think it's got to the point where they said, crikey, the only way we can really raise the sort of money we need to clear the debts and get us back on an even keel would be by selling our building. Now, of course, all of us in the campaign are like, no, don't sell the building, there must be another way. But it's really about this debt that needs clearing and the need for a regular income from investments or whatever to support the charity as well.
So what is it about the building that you think makes it so special?
Well, I mean, the building, the history of the building, I suppose. The building contains the laboratories of Humphrey Davy and Michael Faraday. And I do encourage people to go and visit the museum and go into the laboratory. You'll get a tingle just being there. And the same for the lecture theatre. Since 1825, when the Christmas lectures were started there, the building itself has been an inspiration. You may remember the £20 note used to have a picture of Faraday and that lecture theatre on it. I mean, it's arguably the most famous lecture theatre in the world. So the idea that the building could be sold off and, heaven forbid, turned into a hotel or something like that, just, you know, Faraday would be turning in his grave. There's so much history there as well as the current stuff that's going on that I think it's one of the wonders of the world. It's a cathedral to science, and we cannot lose that building.
I quite like the image of Faraday turning in his grave, because I imagine he'd then put some sort of generator on it to try and generate some current from it. So, I mean, so that we understand the building's historic, but do you think that the RI as an institution could, you know, worst case scenario, survive without it? I mean, for comparison, the Royal Society, which is just down the road, and I couldn't really tell you what the difference is, they've moved like 4 or 5 times in their history.
Well, exactly, and this is perhaps one of the reasons why the building, to me, is so important as a part of the institution. You know, the RI haven't moved. They've stayed in the same place. They have been, I think, it's impossible to contemplate separating the two. You know, many people think of the RI and 21 Albemarle Street as one entity, and the idea of separating them seems criminal. I'm getting emails from people all across the world saying, what are you guys in the UK doing? You know, there must be a better way to raise the money that the Royal Institution needs than to sell this building. And lots of people are emailing saying, you know, we can't let this happen, and we won't let this happen, you know, because of the history of the RI is in that building. And yes, you know, they could go and set up somewhere else. I mean, government could sell off Houses of Parliament and meet somewhere else. But in reality, you know, there are certain people and places that shouldn't be separated. And I think to take the Royal Institution out of the building, it would be like taking the soul of the building out, and to the same in reverse, as it were. The RI without its building just seems madness to me.
So in the past week, then, you've put together this campaign. I see you've got Harry Kroto on board.
Yes.
The Nobel laureate, the man behind Buckyballs.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. That's been brilliant. I mean, it's funny, I did an interview earlier and I saw the writer afterwards had described me as having a love affair with the Royal Institution, and I thought, yeah, this is true. You know, it reaches out to touch everybody and it should be important to everyone. And that's why I set up the Save 21 Albemarle Street campaign last Friday. And when I did that, I said in my little notes that I wrote myself, I want to get everybody from Nobel laureates to dinner ladies involved in the campaign. And what do you know, next day, a Nobel laureate calls me and is like, oh, Harry Kroto, hi, to offer his support. So I don't know if we've got a dinner lady on board yet. If anyone listening is a dinner lady, give me a shout. But, you know, it's great to see so many people coming together to support the campaign. And we've been putting together an action group, a core of about 9 or 10 of us who are going to meet and really come up with a battle plan, as it were, going forward to help the Royal Institution. And we're being supported by loads of people writing in to offer help and support. So that's great to see, really.
Mm. And what can our listeners do right now? I understand you've got a petition going.
Yes, that's right. I mean, first up, it would be great if everybody could just keep an eye on our website, the save21albemarlestreet.com, and follow the Twitter account, which is at Save21Albemarle, and also join the Facebook group, which is again linked to from the website. And yes, we've got this petition, which asks the government to buy 21 Albemarle Street from the RI and essentially gift it back to them and let them remain there. It may be too optimistic a hope that the government will do that, despite the money being involved being really small change as far as they're concerned. But the petition is a very important thing, because the more names we get on that petition, the more evidence we have that you guys all agree with us that this building and the Royal Institution very much matter to the cultural, scientific heritage of the nation and its scientific future. You know, the RI really did put science in the UK on the map, and it and its building are fundamental. And the more names we get on this petition, you know, that really shows the government how important this is. Another thing people can do is join the Royal Institution. Their website is at rigb.org, because the full name is Royal Institution of Great Britain, and it's only like £28 to be an associate member, or £95 to be a full member, or if you're feeling flush, I think it's £295 if you want to be a fellow of the Royal Institution. They let anybody in, which is one of the great things about it. They're not, you know, men in bow ties and puffy societies. You know, anybody can come in and support them, which is one of the things that differentiates it from other societies, perhaps. If people join, that will put money into them. And also there's a donate button on their website as well, so I'd encourage people to do that. Follow the campaign. When we've got a clear idea of all the things we're going to do moving forward, we'll put all that on the website and people can all get involved and really save the building and save the RI.
Excellent. And on that hopefully optimistic note, I'm off to try and find £200 to become a fellow so I can boast about being a fellow. But we'll put links to the campaign and the petition and all that on the Pod Delusion website. But for now, Mary Perkins, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much. And now, the sports news. No, honestly, stay, don't switch off. This is interesting. As you'll be aware, Lance Armstrong has been in the news recently for doping. Now, I don't know about that, but personally, I'm fairly sure that his brother Stretch Armstrong must be taking something. Anyway, it turns out that doping is hugely complex and an interesting thing. So I thought it was a good opportunity to chat to Dr. Mark Burnley, who's a lecturer in physiology at the University of Kent, to find out all about it. This interview also contains some excellent tips if you ever want to run a doping ring. So, for the uninitiated, and let's take a step back. I mean, I consider myself an initiated. I'm not very sporty, but, you know, like everyone else, I loved watching the Olympics. What sort of doping is there? I mean, is it just pills people take or shooting up or...?
There's all sorts, and actually you can go to the WADA website and it will give you the current prohibited list that was actually revised on the published on the 1st of January this year. So you've got the 2013 list, which will tell you in the next year what athletes can be banned for. And they arrange it in substances, methods, and other things like that. So I've compiled a little list because I can't remember them all off the top of my head. But there's anabolic agents, there's peptide hormones, growth factors and related products, There's beta 2 agonists, so you know, your classic Ventolin inhalers and things like that. Hormones and metabolic modifiers, which touches upon gene doping. Then there's diuretics and masking agents for tampering with urine samples. Then there's methods, so blood manipulation, which is your classical blood doping. And then chemical or physical manipulation of a doping control sample. So actually trying to tamper with it in some way. Then there's gene doping is given its own category. Then there's a final shortlist. There's stimulants, so your classic amphetamines, narcotics, cannabinoids, glucocorticosteroids. And then there's specific things that only certain sports ban. So one is alcohol. Another is beta blockade. So if you're a billiard player or a snooker player, you can't use beta blockers. And, you know, that's particularly important there, but it may not be banned in other sports. But previous methods I mentioned, so things like blood doping, anabolic agents are banned for all sports. So, and WADA keep up that list and keep people informed, because obviously athletes need to know about this stuff. And so do the doping control people and the governing body. So it's a very, very comprehensive list, and there shouldn't really be any excuse for getting it wrong.
So in terms of sort of detecting these things, at the moment there's these samples, and I understand that there must be fridges somewhere with like Lance Armstrong's urine and going back years.
Yeah, there are various laboratories around the world that are specifically intended to run doping samples through. So there's labs in Switzerland, there's labs in the United States, there's obviously one now in Essex that can do that as a result of the Olympics. And there are various places that are accredited by WADA to actually perform these tests. And they do store quite a lot of historic samples as well. But what they generally do is receive doping samples from in competition and out of competition testing. And they simply run those through various analyzers, looking for various metabolites, various proteins and things like that, which would indicate that doping has occurred. So the laboratories are actually very, very large, and the equipment used there are very high spec. So you've got quite a lot of very high-end mass spectrometers. But the issue really for doping control is when you take the samples themselves and also what you're actually looking for, because there are certain products that we know about, but if you take THG, for example, at one point we didn't know that this thing was being used or even existed. So you wouldn't be looking in a mass spectra of somebody's urine. You wouldn't be looking for the particular signature of THG. And so fall foul of doping control, even though it was performance enhancing. So I think as time goes on, you're going to get to a point where so many things are being looked for that it actually becomes increasingly difficult to dope and get away with it. The only thing I would say, though, is that the testing is only as good as the frequency with which the testing occurs, because testing in competition, you could argue, is as much as anything a waste of time, because if you're an athlete who knows, or has a team rather, that knows what they're doing, and you're doping on testosterone or some kind of anabolic steroid or EPO or something like that, you're not going to get any benefit from injecting that stuff in competition. You'll get all the benefit of it in the run-up to competition, and then there'll still be some carryover during the competition. So when you're competing, as Lance Armstrong said himself, during the Tour de France, he was effectively clean. So it doesn't matter how many doping controls he's going to go through there, he's not going to be pulled up, even though he was doped up to the eyeballs in the months leading up to the France, as we now know. At the time, outer competition was so patchy that it was unlikely he was going to get an outer competition test whilst he had EPO in his system. And when he did, he just hid in locations that would be very hard for doping control people to find. And even if they knocked on the door, he simply wouldn't answer. And so it's got to the point now where athletes have to give their whereabouts for an hour every day, 365 or 66 days of the year. And they have to be there because doping control could turn up and knock on the door. What a lot of the cyclists did, though, was select a time where they knew they could inject something, and then they'd have as long a washout as possible before doping control would turn up. And so that's a big problem as well. So you could tailor your schedule to get around that as well. So Tyler Hamilton, for example, talked about himself glowing, meaning that he would have stuff in his system that would fall foul of doping control. And he made sure that he'd schedule his intake so that he wasn't glowing at the point where the testers might come knocking. So there were ways and means around it. It's becoming increasingly difficult.
It sounds incredibly involving, both for the doping agencies and the athletes and stuff. So people who do still dope, I mean, presumably it's not just them. Do their teammates know? Do their coaches tend to know? Is it like a conspiracy? Do they tend to be complicit?
Yes, I think the Armstrong case has shown quite clearly the level of collusion there has to be between an athlete, their coach or their manager, and medical and scientific professionals. So, and this is actually a very interesting point, because if you look at cycling particularly, you could probably name three people who were potentially responsible for 95% of the doping that occurred in cycling. And those three people, I won't name all three people, but the two I will name, because they're basically public record now, is Michele Ferrari, who was working with Lance Armstrong throughout his career, and Francesco Conconi. And the interesting thing about Conconi is he was working in Italy in the early 1980s, and he convinced the Italian Olympic Committee to get involved with his testing methods. And his testing methods were shown to have dramatic results, particularly in winter sports like biathlon and things like that. Italy started winning quite a lot of medals. And then a middle distance athletics coach called Sandro Donati was approached by the Italian Olympic Committee to have Francesco Conconi get involved with his athletes. And then Donati realized that this training method that he's using is actually blood doping. Donati logged all of this stuff and over a few years collected enough evidence to make it pretty damning that Conconi was doing this. And he then went to the Italian Olympic Committee, and the Italian Olympic Committee decided to fire Donati because Francesco Conconi was producing such great results. Conconi then subsequently started working in cycling, trained Francesco Moser to break the hour record. It turns out that although he was riding a futuristic bike, the thing that really did for him was the fact that he was injecting large amounts of blood before actually competing in those sorts of events. That's what caused that performance, if you like. Subsequently, Conconi was given several million pounds of funding to come up with a test for the new drug that was coming on the market, EPO. And it turns out what he was using the money for was to more effectively dope athletes using EPO. And as a result, in the mid-1990s, it's estimated that something like 70% of Peloton was using EPO, and an awful lot of that was coming from Conconi. The reason there's a link here is that the person who trained Michele Ferrari in the science of sport and sports medicine was Francesco Conconi. And so there's a direct link from the early 1980s when doping started all the way through to Lance Armstrong's misdemeanors. It's all the same people. So the third person involved, and I won't name him, but it was the latter point of cycling where people like Alberto Contador started getting caught for various things that they were doing. And that was in Spain. There was an awful lot of stuff going on there that we now know about, largely as a result of law enforcement, not WADA, but actually police investigations were bringing this kind of thing to light as well. So that's happened too.
It's been absolutely fascinating getting your insight. We'll leave it there. But for that, thank you very much.
Thanks. Cheers.
Neanderthals hit the headlines this week, which was surprising, not least because they've all been dead for thousands of years. Reports did the rounds that a crazy doctor was looking for a woman to be a surrogate mother for a Neanderthal clone. Whilst these reports may have been slightly wide of the mark, it certainly raises a lot of interesting questions. I mean, for a start, why bother faffing about with all that cloning when you could just invite the EDL to go on a protest if you want to study that behaviour? With more, here's Kash Farouk.
Neanderthals are an extinct species of the genus Homo, named after the site of the first discovery of this species, the Neander Valley in Germany. They are the most closely related species to modern-day humans. They were around at the same time as humans, probably going extinct around 30,000 years ago. That's incredibly recent. We probably shared the Earth with them for 100,000 years or so. There are a couple of hypotheses to explain why they went extinct. Perhaps they didn't cope with climate change as well as Homo sapiens. With the grasslands replacing forests, perhaps their hunting techniques failed. Or perhaps they were just outcompeted by modern humans and killed off. DNA analysis of Neanderthal remains has revealed that modern humans share some nuclear DNA with the extinct Neanderthals. This week, Professor George Church spoke to the German weekly newspaper Der Spiegel about cloning Neanderthals. He is a well-respected Harvard professor of synthetic biology. He was involved with the Human Genome Project. When asked, "Will you witness the birth of the Neanderthal baby in your lifetime?" he answered, "That depends on a hell of a lot of things, but I think so." Scientists have recovered DNA from Neanderthal fossils, and this would form the basis of any cloning attempt. In his book, Professor Church writes that an extremely adventurous female human could serve as the surrogate mother. He also told the news magazine that the prerequisite would, of course, be that human cloning is acceptable to society. The basic idea is that parts of the Neanderthal genome would be introduced into human stem cells, a fetus would be created, and then implanted into the extremely adventurous female human. And why would we want to do this? One of the reasons he gives is, and I quote, "Well, Neanderthals might think differently than we do. We know that they had a larger cranial size. They could even be more intelligent than us. When the time comes to deal with an epidemic or getting off the planet or whatever, it's conceivable that their way of thinking could be beneficial." Okay, I'm going to ignore whether cloning a Neanderthal is technically feasible. It isn't feasible today, but synthetic biology research is progressing rapidly. Who knows what will be possible in 10 to 20 years? I'm also going to ignore the professor's suggestion that Neanderthals could help us build some sort of spaceship or whatever he's suggesting. I'm going to focus on the ethics. The idea of cloning extinct species is fascinating. I'm sure we'd all love to be able to go to a zoo, see a saber-toothed tiger or a woolly mammoth. But cloning a Neanderthal? Ethically, that doesn't sit very well with me. Neanderthals were intelligent. They created and used tools. They were social. What kind of psychological pressure would a Neanderthal be under if it knew that it was the only one of its kind? And would we class them as human, with the same sort of basic human rights? Evidently, they have bred with humans in the past. If the clone Neanderthal wished to breed with Homo sapiens, would it be allowed to? Would we forcibly prevent this? Basically, my question is, would it be ethically sound to create an intelligent species just for scientific curiosity? And would our clones survive on modern Earth anyway? Would we be creating an intelligent species for it to die from the common cold? Their genome would have evolved in response to ancient pathogens and would probably not be able to handle the various microbes that humans deal with every day. Humans also carry around millions of genes in symbiotic organisms. Where would we get their symbiotic organisms from? Would we actually have to keep our intelligent clone isolated in some sort of clean room? Though anatomically similar to modern humans, Neanderthals do have some strikingly different features. Their heads were shorter, they had a less pronounced facial front, their chins and forehead sloped backwards, their nose region protruded forward more. Is it ethically sound to essentially create a modern-day version of a 19th century freak show? Some humans find it impossible to be decent to other humans with a different skin colour. Can you imagine how a Neanderthal would be treated? This is Kash Farouk, with help from Peter Harrison, reporting for The Podillusion.
Now, over in America, the process of fracking has been controversial for some time, but over here the issue is only just starting to crack open and bubble towards the surface. But should we be worried about fracking, and how can we identify the risk? Essentially, we're asking, what the frack? To explain more, here's Drew Ray.
Hi, folks. We have a question this week from a listener, Rob, who asks whether, as a concerned and informed citizen, he should be for or against the practice of fracking. So I guess let's start by explaining what fracking is. The word is a contraction of the phrase hydraulic fracturing. It's a process used in mining for natural gas. Normally, when we're drilling for natural gas, we drill down into very porous rocks, and the gas just sort of flows back out. However, natural gas also occurs in non-porous rocks, such as shale. To get the gas out of these rocks, you need to make your own cracks. This is done by pumping high-pressure liquid down into the rock to create fractures, and then pushing a sandy mixture down to keep the cracks open. Fracking has been going on for a long time. Some sources say since the 1940s. But it's usually only on a very small scale to improve the efficiency of natural gas wells. Using fracking as the primary drilling operation came into widespread use in the last 10 or 15 years. There are three main risks that have got people worried about fracking. Let's take them in order from smallest to biggest concern. The first worry is that the liquid used for fracking contaminates the environment, particularly the local drinking water. This seems to be the biggest area for scaremongering. There's really no evidence that fracking fluid can seep from the shale itself. The shale is typically quite deep, and the whole point of the exercise is that it isn't porous. Liquid can't easily get through it. It's probably the case, though, that fracking fluid has contaminated water supplies. This is fluid that has come back up out of the well and not been disposed of safely. The evidence that this has happened isn't strong, but it's coming from multiple directions and appears to be becoming more solid over time. It's a very real environmental hazard, but it's nothing special about fracking. Most forms of mining create unpleasant or downright dangerous waste, and it isn't always dealt with properly. As a society, we're usually fairly comfortable with this sort of risk. It would be pretty perverse to single out fracking for causing environmental damage. The second worry is that the methane that we're trying to extract might spread into the water supply as a result of fracking. Methane in drinking water is not as uncommon as you might think, and it isn't known to be toxic. If there's enough methane, it can actually catch fire or explode. That's a worry. Concentrations of methane are higher near natural gas wells, and the evidence is mounting that there's a causal relationship. The wells are actually making any natural situation worse. Again, this is almost certainly a result of methane leaking from pipes and wells, rather than directly from the fracking sites. Again, it's nothing special about fracking. It's a known environmental and safety risk coming out of any natural gas operation. The third and biggest worry is that when we pump methane out of the ground, a lot of it ends up in the atmosphere, either directly from the wellheads or when we burn the methane. Even if there's nothing special about fracking in this regard, a whole lot of new natural gas wells is going to mean a whole lot of new methane sources. Proponents of natural gas describe it as greenhouse friendly. Such arguments seldom consider the end-to-end footprint of an energy source. And when it's looked at in this way, fracking doesn't stack up. It really isn't significantly better or worse than any fossil fuel. Which is to say, it's definitely not greenhouse friendly. So, three areas of potential concern, but the best available evidence is that none of these problems is new to fracking. They are legitimate concerns that any community should have if someone proposes new mining or industrial operations nearby. And concentrating on the specific fear of fracking is probably unhelpful. There are some areas of scientific uncertainty, though, that a responsible citizen should be aware of. Probably the biggest uncertainty is that almost all the evidence we have is circumstantial. No one has done enough chemical profiling of areas before fracking to conclusively show that there have or haven't been changes. As a risk and safety professional, I find this disturbing. One of the main reasons for conducting a safety or environmental analysis is so that you know what things to monitor. When local residents complain about changes to the drinking water, a responsible company should already have the before and after measurements, not hypothetical arguments about what is and isn't possible. Equally disturbing is that companies aren't sharing information about what's contained in the fracking fluid. The available evidence suggests that it doesn't particularly matter what's in it, but if the information was published, we'd know exactly what to look for to spot contamination. This would also match existing regulation for major hazards, which supports a public right to know about potential dangers. Finally, the health effects of methane have not been thoroughly studied. If we're going to have more methane about, we ought to have a sound scientific basis for setting tolerable limits. There's no particular reason for concern, and probably the tolerable limits will be based on the risk of fire and explosion rather than toxicity, but it would be nice to know for sure. If you enjoy my Pod Delusion pieces about things that can kill you, you may also like my new podcast, Disastercast. I'll put a link in the show notes, along with a couple of reputable articles on the risks of fracking. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
Now, one of the perennial topics we cover on this show is homeopathy, as it's just so easy to criticise and find amusing. But it does raise the question, if everyone knows that it's nonsense, why is it still sold? Even if most people still think it's real, the pharmacist selling it will certainly know the truth. Chris Chapman is a pharmacist by training, and he's been thinking about why this is, and here he is to explain why.
3 years ago this month, the 1023 campaign protested outside Boots pharmacies across the UK. The reason? The company's sale of homeopathy. As a pharmacy graduate and a former purveyor of everything from detox sachets to magnetic healing trinkets, I'm a little bit embarrassed about the profession's current stance on homeopathy. It seems that it's something that's tolerated by the sector. I'm always fascinated by this. How can someone who went to university and is required to update their clinical knowledge every year believe in the healing properties of sugar pills soaked in magically shaken water? I'm also worried. What effect is this going to have on a profession's reputation? Pharmacists can do so much more. They should be the scientist on the high street. But at the moment, they're almost trapped between two worlds, that of the retailer and that of the health professional. Now, there are only three possible explanations for pharmacists continuing to support homeopathy. Either they believe it works, they don't know if it works and are giving it the benefit of the doubt, or they know it doesn't work, but sell it anyway. So, let's look at all three. The first, that pharmacists believe homeopathy work, is certainly true for some pharmacists. Yet it's hardly representative. Speaking at the Science and Technology Committee, Boots Superintendent Pharmacist Paul Bennett said that the main reason for sales is because a large number of our consumers actually do believe they are efficacious. That doesn't necessarily mean the pharmacist believes it. The Royal Pharmaceutical Society has said that homeopathy is not medicine. Northern Ireland's Pharmaceutical Society even went so far as to issue guidance that pharmacists should always warn patients there is no strong scientific or clinical evidence base for the efficacy of homeopathic products other than having a placebo effect. True believers are in the minority. And yet, in 2009, in a Lambeth basement, Royal Pharmaceutical Society branch reps met to discuss the future of pharmacy. Slough and District Branch proposed an end to the promotion of homeopathy in pharmacies, slamming the current situation as ludicrous and stating firmly that homeopathy has no rational basis. The motion wasn't carried. Opponents demanded that the profession retain an open mind. That leads us to the second explanation. Pharmacists don't know if homeopathy works or not. Certainly, there's no course on it at university. Yet when I went into practice, there were detox kits, magnets, hoppy ear candles. Did they work? I had no idea at all. I just figured my company had checked the evidence base before stocking the product. Fortunately, attitudes are changing. This week, the Royal Pharmaceutical Society tweeted asking people if they were struggling with their January detox. Immediately, pharmacists on Twitter responded, with one quipping, "No, I have a fully functioning liver." This attitude is definitely on the wane. And ignorance is no excuse, not when a patient's care is concerned. To quote pharmacy's regulatory standards, practice only in those areas in which you are competent to do so and refer to others if you need to. If you don't know homeopathy works, it must fall under this category. Let's not forget, too, the internet is a smartphone away. You can find an emphatic evidence base that proves homeopathy just doesn't work better than placebo. So perhaps the final point of our explanation is true for most. Pharmacists don't believe it works and they still continue to sell it. This is where it gets a little bit embarrassing. How can you possibly justify such a viewpoint? I don't think it's a financial motivation, though. Yes, pharmacists are businesses, but so are GP surgeries or dentists. If you called a pharmacist a shopkeeper, they'd be rightly affronted. The job they do is highly skilled and saves and improves patients' lives on a daily basis. Of course, profit is a factor. But I think a pharmacist would rather have a well-treated patient than an extra couple of quid in their pocket. The fact that many pharmacists go above and beyond the call just to make sure their patients get their medicines and are taking them correctly proves the point. My gut feeling, and it's echoed in Boots' sentiments and chats I've had with pharmacists, is that the real reason is customer service. Customers want homeopathy, and if they feel better because they buy some, why is that such a bad thing? Or so the argument goes. If a pharmacist has used their professional, clinical expertise to determine a patient is at no risk, that the condition is self-limiting, what's the harm in giving them homeopathy? As one pharmacist puts it, we can only give our best professional advice on the matter. Having failed to convince the customer, if they want a homeopathic remedy to treat hay fever, they can have one. For me, this argument comes back to the placebo effect debate. If it works, does it really matter why it works? Now certainly, there are actual medicines that probably have next to no effect in many cases. These are still sold, recommended even. What makes homeopathy different from these or a placebo? Simply put, my argument would be public perception. A pharmacist has an authority. A customer walking in with no medical knowledge doesn't appreciate the difference in efficacy or whether a product is classed as a medicine. They just want a product that will help them. They might have heard of homeopathy and asked for it by name, but that would be like me going into a garage and saying that I think my carburetor's a bit faulty. I'm going to trust the mechanic's word over mine. Customers come into a pharmacy, and if a pharmacist gives them a product, they expect it to work. They have a right to expect it to work. There are standards that cover this, of course. To go back to pharmacy's ethical rules, pharmacists must explain the options available to the patient and the public, including the risks and benefits, to help them make informed decisions. Make sure the information you give is impartial, relevant, and up to date. In a new NHS, with locally commissioned services and an increased emphasis on public health, credibility is key. And that's why I'm worried about the effect of stocking something that's unscientific. How is this going to affect the pharmacy profession, or any other profession for that matter? Also, we need to think about what effect it's going to have on homeopathy. A pharmacist's word could lend it an air of false authority, increasing public trust in what is essentially something that must be consigned to the Dark Ages. As a recent systematic review in December's International Journal of Clinical Practice found, such perceptions in the past have had fatal consequences. We can't risk a patient misinterpreting homeopathy and believing that it will affect a long-term condition, or any other condition for that matter, beyond placebo. For pharmacists to take on greater roles in public health, to be recognised more as the scientist on the high street, they must move on from homeopathy. The reasons they're stocking it may be honest and well-meant, but, as the saying goes, the harms outweigh the benefits. This has been Chris Chapman for The Pod Delusion.
Now this week, Europe has been in the news a lot. Our membership of the European Union has become a big deal, and so is going to be put to a referendum. Presumably it will turn out like an argument on an internet forum, so Britain will quit in a massive huff after making a big deal about how he hates the place, only to rejoin a few days later under a different name, and then will deny it's actually the same country as before. This week, David Biggins has been taking a look back at our history in the 1970s to see how we got into this thing in the first place.
The Treaty of Rome was signed on the 25th of March 1957, effectively creating what we now call the European Union, but at the time it was called the European Economic Community, or the EEC. It was originally signed by six countries: Belgium, France, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands and West Germany, and was designed to foster economic integration, principally by creating a common market. I'm not an expert on economics, but a common market essentially removes pesky taxes and paperwork and allows for trade to move freer so that more goods can be sold. More selling means more production, and that hopefully means that everyone gets a little bit richer. Now, I've been reading various articles on David Cameron's current in-out referendum, and they've all been making reference to the first and only referendum on Europe since 1975, but they don't really say much else about the 1975 referendum. Most articles don't even include the fact that the country said yes overwhelmingly to stay within the common market, although to a certain extent I suppose that's obvious. At the time, the question was a simple one. Do you think the United Kingdom should stay in the European Community? 17 million people voted yes, 8 million people voted no, giving a roughly 70-30% split. 64 of the registered electorate turned out to vote, which is about on par with the percentage of voters who turned up in the last general election. The UK was taken into the European Union in 1973 by Edward Heath, who felt it was the pragmatic thing to do for British business. There was also, like today, pressure from the United States, as they felt that France had a little too much influence within the community. The UK would be able to provide a heavyweight chance and rebalance European interests. Plagued by striking miners and laughed at for introducing the three-day working week, the Conservative Party lost the general election in 1974, putting the issue of Europe's future in Labour's hands. Labour won the election with a manifesto pledge that sounded remarkably similar to David Cameron's recent pledge. They wanted to renegotiate the terms of membership, then hold a vote. The hard left were aghast at Britain's entry, and they forced the new Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, to put the issue to a party vote. Despite Wilson being strongly in favour of remaining within the EEC, the Labour Party voted 2-1 against, with 3.7 million of their members wanting to leave. This delighted Labour's future leader Michael Foot, as well as Tony Benn, who had both spearheaded the campaign to leave Europe. They were supported by the trade unions, who basically felt that membership jeopardised British jobs. Regardless of how his party felt, Harold Wilson campaigned to keep Britain within the community alongside Heath and the Conservative Party, who were largely in favour of Europe, which is perhaps surprising when you think of today's backbenchers. With cross-party support, it's hardly surprising that we voted to remain within Europe, and the issue has been kept out of voters' hands now for nearly 40 years. When Labour lost power in 1979, Michael Foot became the leader, and his opposition to Europe became party policy. That and complete UK nuclear disarmament. In 1983, Labour actually included a promise to withdraw from the European Economic Community in its manifesto, and the party was slaughtered at the polls. Labour's European schizophrenia caused its more right-wing members to break away from the party, believing that leaving Europe was madness. Roy Jenkins, David Owen, Bill Rogers and Shirley Williams broke away and founded the more moderate Social Democratic Party. This is of interest today because in 1988 the SDP merged with the Liberal Party to become the Liberal Democrats. It remains to be seen how this will affect today's coalition, but it'd be a piece of delicious irony if this issue actually brought everything full circle and created closer ties between Labour and the Lib Dems.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen back to over 3 years' worth of archives. You can also listen to the Leveson debate from last week. Whilst you're there, please do subscribe or donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusions Week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Cash Farouk, Drew Ray, Chris Chapman, David Biggins, Eon, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Gary the Goat.
What, that bloke who flogs dodgy halal meat in the Platypus and Billabong pub?
No, that's Barry the Beef you're thinking of.
So you mean the bloke that got killed in the Platypus and Billabong?
No, that's Gary the Ghost. I mean the nefarious Gary the Goat, you know, from Sydney.
A Sydneyite? Does he work behind the bar at the Platypus and Billabong then?
Well, you forget about the Platypus and Billabong. He's a goat, a real goat. Lives in Sydney.
Well, what about him?
Well, he's in court last week.
A goat? You're kidding. Yeah, of course he was. Charged with acting the goat.
Charged with eating flowers outside the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney.
Well, I'm not surprised they've arrested a goat for floricide. Sydney's a nanny state.
Look, stop taking the piss, will you? This poor goat was charged with eating flowers outside the gallery and originally fined $400. They finally found him not guilty and they decided the goat hadn't purposely destroyed the vegetation.
Well, what about him?
Well, I just can't help thinking.
Yes?
If he'd have taken a crap on them too, when he'd finished, he could have probably have sold the art installation for $1 million.
You're a cynical man, Brian. Contemporary art seeks to challenge traditional thinking and bring discussion of taboo issues.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that Gary's made the right connections and has gone off to discuss his artistic future with Damien Hirst.
Damien Hirst? But doesn't he,
Crikey! Now it's making sense. Hirst said that Gary could make a big splash and the criticism for his work would be split down the middle, much like Gary.
Oh, well, that sounds nice. Now, how about that drink down the Platypus and Billabong?
How about Gary the Ghost?
Ah, no worries. They're bound to serve spirits.